prepared to do a one-minute monologue and sing 16 measures a cappella. Performance dates are in April. We continue with All Things Considered.
This was an agent recklessly using power that resulted in somebody dying.
After an Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer killed a woman in Minneapolis, the city's mayor sharply criticized the deployment.
Today is Wednesday, January 7th, and this is All Things Considered.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How are President Trump's policy decisions and tactics changing the world order?
We put that question to the head of the Council on Foreign Relations.
This harkens back to when the U.S. would just declare that it was going to use force or other means to expand or to secure access to resources.
Also, the administration has released new dietary guidelines and a reimagined food pyramid.
It puts meat, cheese, and vegetables at the top.
Protein and healthy fats are essential, and we're wrong. Strongly discouraged in prior dietary guidelines.
That's ahead. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump is defending the ICE officer who shot and killed a woman in Minneapolis. In a post on social media, he blames what he calls the radical left for the incident. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports.
Without citing any evidence, Trump accused the, quote, radical left of attacking law enforcement officials, including ICE officers, on a, quote, daily basis. The Department of Homeland Security alleges that an ICE official fired defensive shots at a 37-year-old woman in her car. The Minneapolis police say that preliminary information shows the woman was blocking the street in her car and was approached by law enforcement. The shooting happened as the vehicle drove off, and the woman was later pronounced dead with a gunshot wound to the head. The investigation into the use of deadly force is being led jointly by the FBI and the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, The White House.
President Trump says authorities in Venezuela will turn over 30 to 50 million barrels of oil to the United States. NPR's Ader Peralta reports it's unclear who approved the transfer.
In a social media post, Trump said the 30 to 50 million barrels of oil will be sold at market price and that the proceeds will be controlled by him to, quote, ensure it is used to the benefit of the people of Venezuela and the U.S. Since last year, the United States has enacted what is essentially a naval blockade on Venezuela. Trump said interim authorities approved the transfer, but it's unclear who he's talking about. Trump has said Venezuela's acting president, Delcy Rodriguez, is willing to do what the United States wants. But Rodriguez has been a Maduro loyalist, and at times she has taken a defiant tone in public. An appearance on Tuesday, she sent a message to those who threaten her. My destiny is only decided by God, she says. Ader Peralta, NPR News, Cúcuta, Colombia.
Congressional forecasters say they expect the U.S. population to grow by 7 million fewer people over the next decade than we were projecting this time last year. NPR's Scott Horsley reports that's largely due to the Trump administration's crackdown on illegal immigration.
The Congressional Budget Office projects the U.S. population will grow from 349 million people this year to about 357 million in 2035. That's substantially slower growth than CBO was projecting a year ago. The biggest factor driving the slowdown is immigration policy. Women in the U.S. are also having fewer children than they used to. By 2030, forecasters think there'll be fewer babies born each year in the U.S. than there are deaths. Without newcomers from other countries, the population would begin to decline at that point. CBO also says Americans are living longer, so the fastest growing part of the population will be people over 65. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
House Speaker Mike Johnson sent a letter to President Trump inviting him to deliver the State of the Union address on February 24th. The letter's a formal step to schedule the address. It's NPR News. President Trump says he wants to block large investors from buying houses, saying that a ban would make it easier for younger families to buy their first homes. The president is under pressure to address voters' concerns about affordability ahead of this year's midterm elections. Warner Brothers Discovery has once more rejected a bid from the family of Oracle co-founder Larry Ellison to acquire the company. As NPR's David Folkenflik reports, the parent company of HBO Max and CNN says it's sticking with a bid from Netflix.
Larry Ellison is the co-founder of Oracle and one of the world's richest people. He agreed to personally guarantee $40 billion of his offer, valued at more than $100 billion. With his son David, Ellison now has a controlling stake in Paramount, which owns CBS and Paramount Plus Streaming. They want to combine it with Warner to take on Netflix, Amazon, Apple, and a bulked-up Disney. Warner Brothers Discovery chairman Sam DiPiazza told CNBC, no dice, though Netflix doesn't want its cable channels.
Ultimately, he didn't raise the price. So in our perspective, Netflix continues to be the superior offer, a clear path to closing.
DiPiazza argues that antitrust regulators in the U.S. and abroad would be more likely to knock down a takeover by Paramount. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
Millions of people are celebrating Orthodox Christmas today, nearly 2 weeks after much of the world marked the holiday. The difference stems from calendar changes made in the 16th century. Some Eastern Orthodox churches, including Russian traditions, follow the Julian calendar, which runs 13 days behind the Gregorian calendar. I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
6 minutes after 5 o'clock, you're listening to All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Taking a look at weather tonight, areas of fog, mostly cloudy, lows near 24 and patchy fog early tomorrow, then partly sunny, highs near 34 with winds from the west 5 to 10. For Friday, mostly cloudy, highs near 29. At 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find more stories at kaxe.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In Minneapolis today, an Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer shot and killed a woman while agents were conducting what ICE calls, quote, targeted operations. Trump administration officials claimed the agent feared for his life and fired in self-defense. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, a Democrat, sharply disputes that. Joining us from Minneapolis with the latest is reporter Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio. Hey there, Matt.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Start with the backdrop here. ICE has been on the ground. They've been in Minneapolis last year, now again at the beginning of this year. So update from there to what happened this morning.
Well, video shows a maroon Honda SUV blocking Portland Avenue. This is a one-way street south of downtown Minneapolis. Federal agents are heard telling the driver, ma'am, get out of the car. The footage taken by a witness shows one federal officer walk around the right side of the car and around the front. Moments later, two other agents walk up to the driver's side. One tries to open the door. At this point, the driver begins to reverse on the icy street. As the officer hangs on the door, the driver begins to drive away from the scene. And then an officer in front of the SUV appears to fire into the car three times. The driver was pronounced dead at a hospital. At a news conference this afternoon, Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara described the deceased as a 37-year-old white woman. He said that she was not the subject of any immigration actions. This incident comes as the Department of Homeland Security is stepping up immigration enforcement in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area with what the department says is 2,000 agents. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem visited the area yesterday.
Okay, and then what is the Trump administration? What is their account of what happened this morning? Because so far they've said the shooting was justified.
Administration officials immediately tried to take control of the narrative. On social media, DHS called the woman a, quote, violent rioter who, quote, weaponized her vehicle. The agency says the ICE agent fired in self-defense. The president also posted on his website saying the woman was obviously a professional agitator. DHS Secretary Kristi Noem spoke to reporters about the incident during a news conference today in Texas.
This goes to show the assaults that our ICE officers and our law enforcement are under every single day. These vehicle rammings are domestic acts of terrorism. We're working with the Department of Justice to prosecute them as such. We will continue to protect our ICE officers and in cooperation with other law enforcement agencies as well.
However, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey was clearly angry during his own news conference today. He called the ICE officers' actions reckless and said Noam's version of events is not what happened.
Having seen the video of myself, I want to tell everybody directly, that is
And using another expletive, Frey said ICE should get out of Minneapolis. He added that the Trump administration is trying to sow chaos and that he and city leaders had feared exactly this outcome when ICE started its enforcement push here.
Let me ask about reaction from other stakeholders as we try to sort through what we know and what we don't. You mentioned Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara joined the mayor at the press conference. What else did he say?
He says the FBI and Minnesota's Bureau of Criminal Apprehension are investigating and added that most law enforcement agencies train their officers to avoid situations like this where they have to use deadly force.
And just quickly, Minnesota's governor, has he weighed in?
Yeah, Governor Tim Walz, also a Democrat, said he is preparing to mobilize Minnesota's National Guard. Walz called the administration's operations dangerous and sensationalized and a threat to public safety.
What we're seeing is the consequences of governance designed to generate fear, headlines, and conflict. It's governing by reality TV. And today that recklessness costs someone their life.
Walz, like Mayor Frey, urged demonstrators to protest peacefully and not give the Trump administration the show that it's seeking.
Reporting there from Matt Sepik with Minnesota Public Radio. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has released new dietary guidelines calling for a significant reset in nutrition policy and, quote, an end to the war on saturated fat. As NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, the new guidelines come with a new food pyramid that upends years of nutrition advice.
For many years, Americans have been told to consume low-fat dairy and limit foods that are high in saturated fat, such as red meat. But Secretary Kennedy and his team have a new vision. Their reimagined food pyramid features at the very top a steak, a turkey, and a wedge of cheese.
Protein and healthy fats are essential, and were wrongly discouraged in prior dietary guidelines. We are ending the war on saturated fats.
The new messaging on saturated fat is controversial. Dr. Christopher Gardner of Stanford University was a member of the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee that reviewed all the nutrition evidence.
I'm very disappointed in the new pyramid that teaches red meat and saturated fat sources at the very top, as if that's something to prioritize. It does go against decades and decades of evidence and research.
Both the American Heart Association and the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, which includes thousands of nutrition professionals, point to evidence that excess saturated fat is linked to heart disease. Here's the Academy's Allison Stiber.
In medicine and certainly in nutrition, it is our responsibility to follow where the preponderance of evidence lies. And that for saturated fat means a reduction in saturated fat.
Though as nutrition science has evolved, experts say not all foods that contain saturated fat have the same effect on the body, and some may be beneficial. Dr. Dariush Mozafarian is a cardiologist who directs the Food as Medicine Institute at Tufts University. He points to milk, cheese, and yogurt.
It's pretty clear that whole fat dairy is not bad for you compared to non-fat dairy. And so I think it's actually quite evidence-based to remove any specific recommendation for Americans to specifically select low-fat dairy.
The new guidelines also push for lower consumption of refined carbohydrates and highly processed foods. Mozafarian says he supports this.
Highly processed foods are clearly harmful for a range of diseases. So to have the U.S. government recommend that a wide class of foods be eaten less because of their processing is a big deal, and I think a very positive move for public health.
At a time when more than two-thirds of American adults are overweight or obese, and poor diets are a leading cause of chronic disease, the challenge is to get Americans to change their habits. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Politicians in Denmark are dealing with widespread fears over U.S. officials' statements about taking over the Danish territory of Greenland. The massive Arctic island is sparsely populated, but President Trump has repeatedly said it is also crucial for American security interests and that it should be part of the United States. Reporter Adrian Murray in Copenhagen reports that very few Danes or Greenlanders think that's a good idea.
In Denmark's snow-covered capital, Trump's repeated threats to take over Greenland have been seen as a serious provocation. But still there's hope that tensions might thaw as Danish and Greenlandic officials meet with the US Secretary of State next week. Lars Løkke Rasmussen is Denmark's foreign minister.
I have asked for a meeting to replace the shouting competition on social media with a more sensible dialogue.
Here in the halls of the Danish parliament, all the talk is about President Trump's threats to take over Greenland, an autonomous Danish territory. And especially American officials saying using military force remains an option. The latest discussions are about alleged American plans to not invade, but buy it. But there's a problem with that plan, says Aya Chemnitz, a member of parliament from Greenland.
Greenland is not for sale, never will be for sale. So that's the opinion from the Greenlandic people and the majority in Greenland.
For the 57,000 strong, largely Inuit population there, the bullying, tough talk of a superpower is not just a worry. It's a source of frustration, says Masana Eil, the editor-in-chief of Greenlandic newspaper Samitsiak.
It's not gone down well in Greenland. We've heard it before, and we're hearing it again. And the problem is that the Greenlandic people do not want to be annexed or taken over by another country, no matter who they are.
Denmark has committed $15 billion to boosting Arctic defence and to respond to Trump's claims that the US needs Greenland for security reasons. But experts here still don't understand the president's rationale. Peter Viggo Jakobsen is from the Danish Defence Academy.
It's very, very hard to see what the US would gain from taking over Greenland. They already have military bases up there, and they have a base agreement allowing them to build any additional base or any additional installation that they would want. They can also make a mineral agreement with Greenland if they so desire.
The bells of the Parliament building ring out over the freezing winter streets of Copenhagen as the politicians get down to work. Greenlandic Representative Chemnitz says all the talk of money and security threats can only fall on deaf ears back home.
If we were to be American, our society would completely change. So I don't see a majority in Greenland being interested. And you can wave as much money as you want in front of the Greenlanders. And I don't think that's the way forward.
The way forward for Denmark's leaders is to take that message to US officials in next week's talks. And to hope that the country's partners in the European Union and NATO continue to stand by it in trying to persuade the American president to give up his plans to take over Greenland. For NPR News, I'm Adrienne Murray in Copenhagen.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Sometimes in the cold of winter, it's hard to think about getting outside. But winter, some people think, can form our character and can bring out the best in us. That's why when you tune into KEXC, you hear about the events going on in our region, whether that means live music or outdoor opportunities at places like the Sachsen Bog in Meadowlands, or skating at the Northland Arboretum in Brainerd, or maybe it's the walks with the Cohasset Parks and Rec Department. So many things are happening throughout our region, including cross-country and downhill skiing. We'd love to hear from you. Tell us what's happening in your community during the wintertime. Text 218-326-1234.
It is 519. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from the Veteran Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of first call for help 211 and provides free crisis assessments, stabilization services, referrals, and resourcing to veterans and their families who are in crisis. Trained providers are available to serve fellow veterans 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211. We also thank Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, a broadband cooperative featuring all-fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. Areas of fog tonight, mostly cloudy, lows near 24, partly sunny tomorrow once the fog burns off, highs near 34. More news is next on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Make America great again. That phrase has been in our political ecosystem for 10 years now, but it's never been entirely clear what time period in American history President Trump is referencing. Is it the 1980s? Maybe the 1950s? What about further back, say the 1890s? As we enter the second year of Trump's second term, his major policy decisions and tactics increasingly rival the imperial Gilded Age presidencies of the late 1800s. There's Trump's tariff policies, which echo the Tariff Act of 1890. In the late 19th century, many government personnel decisions were made with no apologies, with two goals in mind: boosting the backers of the party in power and rewarding people and companies who made financial contributions to that ruling party. Back then, it was the railroad industry. Now, AI is the billion-dollar industry, and its leaders are courting favors with the Trump White House. Then, there's foreign policy. From 1867 to 1899, the United States acquired several territories, including Alaska, Hawaii, and Puerto Rico. Now, in 2026, President Trump has declared the U.S. will, quote, run Venezuela after the seizure and ouster of President Nicolas Maduro. And he and top aides like Stephen Miller are talking about other international moves, too, using blunt language about U.S. military force and U.S. raw strategic interests that, by and large, went away in the 20th century. Here's Miller on CNN.
We live in a world in which you can talk all you want about international niceties and everything else, but we live in a world, in the real world, Jake, that is governed by strength, that is governed by force, that is governed by power.
So how is the second Trump administration changing the world order? That's something we are going to discuss with Michael Froman. He is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations and served as President Obama's trade representative. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with the U.S. military going into Venezuela and seizing its president. What was your response? What did you think about?
Well, first, I don't think that there's any great tears to be shed over Maduro, who was a ruthless leader and alleged to be quite corrupt and criminal in his activity. You know, however, going in and decapitating a government certainly seemed at odds with the president's initial views on regime change and getting involved in the internal affairs of other countries. We now have a situation where we've sort of done regime change without, at least so far, changing the regime, and that we've got the rest of the Maduro government, including the defense minister, the interior minister, the vice president, who's now acting president, very much maintaining control. You know, I think from an international perspective, as you said, this harkens back to a period of time when the U.S. would just declare that it was going to use force or other means to expand or to secure access to resources. I think one of the big questions is, how do other countries interpret this?
You've talked about a phrase we've heard a lot, the rules-based international order. This is something the Biden administration was very focused on. This is something American allies in Europe talk a lot about, the idea that there is a set rules and standards, and countries have to follow them. And the argument you hear from Stephen Miller and others in the Trump White House is that's bogus, that's a veneer that's never been true, and foreign policy is about strength, and it's about power, and it's about the U.S. seizing what it wants. What happens to the world if that's U.S. foreign policy going forward?
So, certainly power has always been an element of international relations, but post-Second World War, the U.S. decided that it could exert global leadership, and it could exert its power most effectively by getting other countries to buy into a set of rules that more or less we designed and that served our interests very well for a long period of time. Now, sometimes that involved us constraining our own capacity to act unilaterally, but it certainly prevented other countries from doing that, or it tried to prevent that. And no rules-based system is perfect. You know, in the international legal system, I think if most countries follow most of the rules most of the time, it has been deemed a success.
But does Miller have a point, though, that might have been right all along? Like the U.S. and its allies have not seen it in their interest to go to war with Russia and Ukraine directly. No one stopped the United States from seizing Maduro. And now Miller's saying, who's going to stop America if it seizes Greenland?
So I think Stephen Miller is right that the power matters and how you exercise power matters. I think the question is, we have been successful for 80 years in using our power and U.S. leadership to shape a system that all of the other countries bought into more or less, and that one kept the peace broadly in the world. What this administration has done is said, look, we're going to put that to the side. And we're going to go back in many respects to, as you suggested, an earlier period where what mattered was your hard power and how you exercised it and whether any other country could stand up to you in doing so. And we do have the largest military in the world, and we do spend more on our military than the next several countries combined. We have real challenges out there, including China, that is engaged in a major military modernization plan and a major military modernization build out. But we are still the dominant military power in the world. And the question is, how do we use that military power?
I mean, you're speaking about this very rationally and strategically, but don't we have a lot of evidence at this point that a lot of the decision making is just, I would like to add to the United States, I would like to leave my mark in one way or another with the Trump White House and President Trump specifically? Like, it seems like he's talked out loud about that being kind of what part of the reasons he's taking these actions.
Well, look, a little bit like the comment about running Venezuela, but basically doing it, you're leaving the current government in place and really focusing on a few issues that the U.S. cares a lot about, like oil, not so much on democracy or on economic reform in Venezuela, et cetera. I think one could take that same approach to Greenland. I think there are really serious issues of Arctic security, and we ought to be more engaged in the Arctic Circle, particularly with climate change. As the polar ice caps are melting, that becomes a much more viable trade route. And so, you know, we should be more engaged up there for our own national security. And the Danes and the Greenlanders are very happy to cooperate with us. And there's even a framework, there's even an agreement between us as to how we would, how we could further build out our cooperation in that area. But I think the president is right. We probably do need to engage much more actively with Greenland and Denmark and ensure that we've got the capacity on Greenland to address our Arctic security needs.
Has any of this surprised you based on what President Trump and his top advisors talked about heading into their second term?
Yes, I'd say there was a lot of expectation coming into the second term that the president was going to be an isolationist. And he is clearly not an isolationist. He has been deeply engaged internationally from day one. And what we've seen is, whether it's regime change in Venezuela or the state building that is slated to go on in Gaza around the ceasefire plan that the president negotiated, that this is very much involves active U.S. participation and active personal participation by the president.
That's Michael Froman, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
It's 529. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, offering fresh baked popovers, crafted cocktails, and menu items such as walleye a la Ritz or chicken Kiev. Information about their dinner menu at timberlakelodgehotel.com. Areas of fog overnight with lows near 24 and patchy fog early tomorrow, partly sunny, highs near 34.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report.
Governor Tim Walz is urging Minnesotans to stay calm after federal agents with Immigration and Customs Enforcement shot and killed a woman in her car Wednesday in Minneapolis. The governor also issued a warning order to the Minnesota National Guard in the event of social unrest. With 2,000 agents deployed into the Twin Cities as the state remains in a national political spotlight, Walz said in a press conference Wednesday that the shooting death was avoidable.
It's beyond me that apparently from the federal government, from the Homeland Security Director herself, has already determined who this person was, what their motive was, and they hadn't even been taken out of the vehicle. We're not living in a normal world.
During an unrelated news conference Wednesday, Homeland Security Director Kristi Noem says the federal agent acted in self-defense and called it a, quote, act of domestic terrorism. She says the woman was attempting to run over an ICE agent, appearing to contradict eyewitness accounts and video live streamed from the scene. Walz says there has been no communication between federal and state agencies for the immigration deployment, which has been met with protest demonstrations.
I think the thing that is so challenging in the moment we're in is we don't see a desire to work with us on public safety. We hear a demonization of our state. We see people coming in who don't know our community, and we see this massive display for the TVs that we're trying to understand how is this coordinated.
The victim was identified by the Minnesota Star Tribune as 37-year-old Renee Good, whose mother said she lived in the Twin Cities. Another potential layer of fraud within the state's beleaguered Department of Human Services is being targeted by a legislative auditor. The Minnesota Reformer reports legislative auditor Judy Randall spoke before a panel of lawmakers Tuesday, outlining the findings of a multi-year audit of the Behavioral Health Administration's grant-making practices. The partial review covered about $192 million in grants issued to nearly 600 non-government entities between 2022 and 2024. Randall says many documents were either backdated or created after the audit began in what appeared to be a systemic effort within the department. The audit also revealed other worrisome issues, such as a widespread reliance on non-competitive single-source bids, poor oversight of grantees, failure to conduct site visits, and lax documentation. In one instance, a grant manager approved a payment of nearly $700,000 to a new vendor for 1 month's work, then left state employment a few days later. That unnamed grant manager subsequently provided consulting services to the new vendor. Acting DHS Commissioner Shireen Gandhi told lawmakers that one internal audit conducted by the department was referred to law enforcement, and the agency is working to improve oversight and training for grant managers. Environmental organization CURE is asking the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission to reassess the private equity sale of Minnesota Power, given new information about the power provider's data center plans. Megan Buffington has more.
While the PUC was considering the sale, a Minnesota Power employee testified that there were no specific plans related to data centers, but data requests related to the controversial data center proposed in Hermantown have since revealed the company was at that time actively discussing it with city staff. Additionally, one of the power provider's new owners, Global Infrastructure Partners, recently announced plans to invest billions in data centers. CURE says those two facts are enough to justify additional investigation.
It's not a smoking gun. It's the fact that there's clearly some information that hasn't been disclosed that could show a conflict of interest.
Hudson Kingston is CURE's legal director. He says no one knows who is proposing the Hermantown data center, but there is reason to think GIP might be involved at some level. CURE isn't asking the commission to reverse the sale, but rather reopen the record and take further testimony on data center development and protections against conflicts of interest. Minnesota Power disagreed with the petition, stating it is not a data center developer, and the issues raised are not related to the acquisition or one of its projects. The company's formal reply to the petition is expected in the coming days. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals whose ideas, solutions, and discoveries expand people's expectations of what's possible. macfound.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Venezuela's political opposition had long sought to remove President Nicolas Maduro from power and restore the country's democracy. U.S. forces took care of the first part of that scenario, but a democratic revival in Venezuela still seems a long way off. That is because Maduro's replacement is a hardline socialist just like him. Meanwhile, as John Otis reports, Venezuela's political opposition remains deeply divided and unclear about what to do next.
That's opposition lawmaker Tomas Guanipa. He was demanding freedom for political prisoners during the opening session of Venezuela's National Assembly on Monday. But Guanipa, whose brother is one of the country's more than 800 political prisoners, was quickly silenced by pro-regime lawmakers.
Es una asamblea donde hay un ambiente de autoritarismo muy marcado.
The atmosphere is very authoritarian, Guanipa said by phone from Caracas. Maduro is gone, but there is still almost no room inside Venezuela for dissent. Regime loyalists control all branches of power. They hold every governorship, most city halls, and 90% of the seats in the legislature. Except for a few lawmakers like Guanipa, most opposition figures remain in hiding or in exile. As for opposition leader and Nobel Peace Prize recipient Maria Corina Machado, she has been effectively sidelined by President Trump. Instead, Trump has chosen to work with, for now, interim President Delcy Rodriguez. That's despite the fact that, over the past 13 years, Rodriguez fully supported Maduro as he jailed opponents, crushed protests, and rigged elections. Still, speaking with Sean Hannity of Fox News, Machado praised Trump's decisions.
What he has done, as I said, is historic. It's a huge step towards a democratic transition.
However, Secretary of State Marco Rubio has said that new elections in Venezuela are not a priority for the U.S. Meanwhile, Interim President Rodriguez, who is despised by many Venezuelans, will likely try to placate Trump while blocking any democratic opening. So says Phil Gunson, who's based in Caracas for the International Crisis Group.
The biggest threat is an outbreak of democracy. This is kryptonite for these people. Democracy will see them thrown out.
Gunson says the opposition miscalculated by putting the country's future in Trump's hands.
Trump had his own agenda, that it was not the same agenda as the opposition leadership.
That's Paola Bautista de Alemán, an opposition activist who fled Venezuela last year. She says it may only be through Trump's threat of further military intervention that the regime allows for free elections. As for Machado, who left Venezuela last month to pick up her Nobel Prize, some think she should return home. She's Venezuela's most popular politician after running the opposition's 2024 presidential campaign that, according to electoral observers, crushed Maduro at the polls. Andres Izarra is a former government minister who broke with Maduro 10 years ago.
If I were Maracorina, I would go to Venezuela right now and go start organizing on the streets, you know, and mobilizing all that people. That people that voted for her, they're still there.
Machado has vowed to return, but for now, it may be too dangerous. Maduro holdovers control the army and police, plus thousands of paramilitaries. Not helping matters are festering rivalries within the opposition itself. For example, Machado refuses to work with opposition lawmakers like Juanipa, whom she views as traitors for serving in a national assembly controlled by the regime.
Ahí es donde yo creo que está el gran error estratégico de quienes han liderado la oposición venezolana.
For his part, Juanipa says Machado and other exiled politicians have made their own blunders, such as breathlessly promising regime change.
Y los liderazgos se van venciendo cuando no da resultado y cuando prometes cosas que no ocurren.
Leadership has an expiration date, he warns, especially when leaders promise things that don't happen. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Bogota, Colombia.
Now to Los Angeles, where today Nick Reiner was expected to be arraigned and to enter a plea. 32-year-old Reiner is accused of killing his father, director Rob Reiner, and his mother, Michelle Singer Reiner. Steve Futterman was in the courtroom today in L.A. and joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
Steve, tell us what happened today.
Well, I have to say this was quite a surprise. Unexpectedly, Nick Reiner's high-profile attorney, Alan Jackson, withdrew from the case. Now, there had not been any hints of this. In fact, we all thought this was going to be pretty routine. But when it was delayed, the hearing, by more than an hour, many of us in the courtroom began to wonder, might something be going on? In court, Alan Jackson said he had no choice, and afterwards he spoke to reporters.
I had to withdraw as Nick Reiner's counsel. Circumstances beyond our control, but more importantly, circumstances beyond Nick's control, have dictated that, sadly, it's made it impossible for us to continue our representation of Nick.
Now, legally, he's not allowed to say what the reason was. However, there's been much speculation about how Jackson's being paid. Was it by the Reiner family, the two surviving children? Might Nick Reiner actually have access to funds? And Jackson now has been replaced by a public defender, Kimberly Green. So finances may have played a role here. Now, as he departed the case, Alan Jackson defiantly made this final comment, which raised some different questions.
What we've learned, and you can take this to the bank, is that pursuant to the laws of this state, pursuant to the law in California, Nick Reiner is not guilty of murder. Print that. Print that.
And the key words there, pursuant to the law. It does seem to suggest, Juana, that a potential defense, which has been discussed, might be an insanity defense because of Nick Reiner's long history of substance abuse. But that is now up to a new attorney from the public defender's office.
You mentioned there an insanity defense might be an option. Historically, is that likely to succeed?
Well, in California, it's not that easy. There are complications. Listen here to former federal prosecutor Lori Levinson.
One option would be not guilty by reason of insanity, but the standard is very high in California to show that. And given that Nick Reiner was functioning in other ways on the days of the killing, that might be a hard argument to make.
Another possible defense might deal with Reiner's mental capacity at the actual time of the killings, and perhaps the defense could argue a more appropriate charge might be second-degree murder. But again, his new lawyer is going to have to assess all the evidence and come up with a decision. Meanwhile, the district attorney, Nathan Hochman, he also met with reporters and said he believes it's still a very strong case.
We are fully confident that a jury will convict Nick Reiner beyond a reasonable doubt of the brutal murders of his parents, Rob Reiner and Michelle Singer Reiner, and do so unanimously.
Steve, tell us, what happens now?
Well, behind the scenes, Nick Reiner's new attorney needs to talk with her client, actually meet her client, introduce herself, and they will discuss possible strategies. It might include an insanity defense. But the arraignment after this second delay is now scheduled to take place on February 23rd.
That's reporter Steve Futterman at the courthouse in Los Angeles. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Juana.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Paralympic Winter Games start this March in Italy. Athletes will compete in six sports, including para ice hockey. But women who play are looking ahead to 2030, when they hope to compete in their own category. They recently inched closer to that goal with the first ever Women's Para Ice Hockey World Championships. Emily Chin Newton reports.
Para ice hockey is similar to wheelchair rugby, fast-paced and physical, but on the ice, and of course not in wheelchairs. In modified sleds on top of skate blades, athletes propel themselves across the rink using two short hockey sticks capped with ice picks.
Try again, girl. Get out!
That's Rachel Steffen, practicing with her local team on her home ice in Cincinnati, Ohio, after competing at the World Championships in Slovakia in August. She and Team USA took home the gold, but a women's category in the Paralympics is what they really want.
It's a great feeling to know that we're so close, and we have reached so many milestones.
This event was the most significant milestone yet, with more global participation than ever before, which is crucial for Paralympic inclusion. Steffen joined the women's national team just this year, so she's grateful to those who've been forging this path since before she even started skating.
People who've been on the team for years and years and years, and learning their stories and how long it's taken to just get a championship, it's crazy.
One of those women is Peggy Asink, who now in her 40s represents Canada. She started when she was just 11 years old.
Back in the 80s and 90s, there was definitely no pathway for women.
Though this sport is technically open to all genders, women are rarely selected for Paralympic teams. Asink points out that hockey is the only large team winter sport in the Paralympics, and so it plays a role in the overall gender imbalance of the competition. In the last Winter Games, only about a quarter of athletes were women.
Because para ice hockey has eight teams that are mostly made up of men, and what we'd really like to be doing is making that much closer to 50%. And one of the best ways to do that is to really be including eight national teams full of women included in Winter Paralympics.
It'll be a big jump because only three women have ever played on Paralympic hockey ice. One of those is Lena Schroeder of Team Norway. Her ability to read the game, she says, is part of how she meshed with the men in the 2018 games.
They gave more checks than me, but I could have this overview and control how our line would respond. So we kind of complemented each other, I would say.
In this game so dependent on upper body strength and mass, men do have an advantage, especially when it comes to hockey's signature move, body checking.
In stand-up regular ice hockey, there are regulations as to how much the female players can actually check each other, but that rule doesn't apply in para.
So it's full contact, she says.
Oh, it's a T-bone, I'm sorry.
We're fine.
Rachel Steffen back on the rink apologizing for one of the only moves not allowed. As practice wraps up, she says her teammates are like family. And now she's imagining not only herself, but other little hockey sisters making it to the Paralympics one day.
Like, I see all the girls that are just now starting, and because since we're so close, I could get to see them also in the Paralympics one day. And that makes me so happy.
For NPR News, I'm Emily Chen Newton in Cincinnati.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It's 5:48. I'm Jennifer Barr. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And 7 o'clock tonight, Isaac M., one of our brand new volunteers, hosting On the River. It's a great mix of music. And 10 o'clock, more great music continues on Headwaters with Kari Hedlund. Support comes from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. And we thank Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu at rapidsbrewingco.com. Areas of fog tonight, mostly cloudy, lows near 24 and patchy fog. Early tomorrow, then partly sunny, highs near 34, winds from the west 5 to 10. Our lows on Thursday night in the low teens, and for Friday, mostly cloudy, highs near 29. Itasca Waters continues their Practical Water Wisdom webinar series tomorrow at noon. This month, hear about traditional ecological knowledge with Shane Bow, Water Resources Director for the Red Lake Nation DNR. Register at itascawaters.org. And Happy Dancing Turtle invites all ages to participate in their winter bingo scavenger hunt now until January 15th. Look for the 24 items on your bingo card, and there's a special focus on animal tracks. Find a registration link and more details at happydancingturtle.org. There is more ahead from All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. One of the most notorious spies in U.S. history, Aldrich Ames, died yesterday at the age of 84. He was serving a life sentence in federal prison in Maryland. Before being caught, though, he did a lot of damage. As a CIA officer, Ames started selling highly classified secrets to the Soviet Union for nearly a decade, starting in the mid-1980s, which led to the arrest and execution of numerous agents recruited by the CIA. We're joined now by John McLaughlin, who's with the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He also served in the CIA when Ames was arrested. Welcome.
Thank you, Juana.
Just start, if you can, by telling us who Ames was and about his career in the CIA before he began spying for the Soviets.
Ames was what we would call an operations officer, a case officer, who worked in different parts of the world, operating undercover and meeting foreign nationals and attempting to recruit them as assets, as spies for the CIA. Eventually, he gravitated to the division at CIA that worked on the Soviet Union. And as he rose in his career, he became an officer in what we called the counterintelligence area of the Soviet office.
How did he begin spying for the Soviet Union? Like, what was his motive?
Well, motives are always hard to define in the case of spy cases. We tend to use an acronym, MICE, M-I-C-E, which stands for money, ideology, compromise, and ego. Those four characteristics are things that we often look at when we're trying to understand spying. Ames is an odd case, but I think money was a big factor, and I would say in an odd sort of way, ego. That is, people get a thrill sometimes out of spying, and in his case, I'm not sure it was a thrill so much as it was a kind of cynicism about the fact that his career hadn't gone as well as he hoped. So there was a kind of ego factor, but I would say the big driver was money.
Can you describe or characterize the type of information that he shared with the Soviet Union?
In the first instance, and what brought to our attention the possibility of what we would call a mole in our midst, was the disappearance of a key agent. I would say one of the very best, most productive agents the CIA ever had in Moscow. His name was General Polyakov. And he reported to us for years on many aspects of Soviet policy. As one person said, he didn't so much prevent the Cold War or end the Cold War as he did from keeping it from going hot. He began to run into trouble and then eventually disappeared. And in fact, subsequently, we learned and know now that he was executed by the Soviets in 1988. And in all likelihood, that his identity was given to them by Rick Ames.
What sort of impact did the information that he shared have on the CIA? And what was the scope of the information that he shared?
The thing that everyone talks about is that he identified our assets and at least 9 or 10 of them were executed by the Soviets after being investigated in the Soviet Union and identified.
Did you know him personally?
I met him a few times.
Well, what was your impression of him then?
My impression of him comes mostly from people who knew him better and would comment on him. And he was, I guess, a so-so officer in terms of his professional performance and had a number of personal characteristics that ultimately drew attention to him as the search for a mole narrowed down. I mean, the agency started with about 160 suspects. In other words, when you have a spy, you ask yourself who in your midst had knowledge of the kinds of information that are certifiably being lost. So he gave himself away by spending too lavishly on his lifestyle. Ultimately, the people who discovered this and the investigating team was most importantly driven by two outstanding women who began to notice a correlation between times when he would meet with Soviets at the embassy, which he was authorized to do for purposes of just general discussion, but they noticed a correlation between the times when he met with them and the times when there were large bank deposits by Ames.
Looking back at this entire story, do you think that something like this could happen again today?
Yes. I have no reason to believe that. I'm not in the intelligence world at this time. But at the end of the day, this is a human activity. At the end of the day, humans are humans. And they have emotions. And the issue of trust is as emotional an issue as anything else. There's a reason why this part of the intelligence world is called the wilderness of mirrors, because you're constantly looking 360 degrees to understand what is going on.
John McLaughlin is a professor at Johns Hopkins University. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Juana.
It's a new year, and we can probably all use a little serendipity, am I right? The word has been used to describe all kinds of good fortune, but its origin suggests that serendipity goes beyond mere happenstance. NPR's Juliana Kim explains in this week's installment of Word of the Week.
Okay, see this book?
Yeah.
Okay, so when I get home tonight, I'm going to write my name and my number inside this book. And then first thing tomorrow morning, I'll sell it to a used bookstore.
When you hear the word serendipity, what comes to mind? A happy accident? A remarkable coincidence? Or maybe it's the charming 2001 romantic comedy about chance encounters starring John Cusack and Kate Beckinsale.
Well, now every time you go past an old bookstore, you're going to have to go inside and see if it's there.
Long before serendipity was the title of a popular movie, the word was tucked away in a letter to a friend penned by English politician and author Horace Walpole in 1754. Language scholar Colin Gorrie says,
he sort of coins the word in the middle of the letter, saying, this thing that happened to me, I found the coat of arms of this one noblewoman completely by accident. I wasn't looking for it, but I found it, and it was a real instance of what I like to call serendipity.
Walpole said he drew inspiration from an old Persian fairy tale about three princes from Serendip, which was a former name for Sri Lanka. Walpole's letter reads,
as their highnesses traveled, they were always making discoveries by accidents and sagacity of things which they were not in quest of.
Over the years, that element of finding has been somewhat lost in how people use serendipity.
It's less to do with finding and more just to do with happening.
But Sanda Erdelis of Simmons University says the act of seeking is crucial to serendipitous moments.
What matters is not just chance, but how people recognize this opportunity and then how they act on that opportunity.
Erdelis has studied how people come across information important to them, either unexpectedly or when they're not actively looking for it. She found that these people tend to be highly curious, involved in different hobbies, and a crucial step, they excel in the art of noticing.
They have more tendency to stop and smell roses.
So for those wanting more serendipity this year, she says free up your schedule to give chance a good chance to happen. Juliana Kim, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. This is NPR.
It's just before 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXE.org, or you can ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. 7 o'clock tonight, Isaac M., your volunteer host for On the River. Areas of fog tonight, mostly cloudy, lows near 24. Patchy fog early tomorrow morning, then partly sunny.